a king, live his life as a slave. How you scared to lead a hood, but you ain't scared of a grave. I've been to 31 states and everywhere it's real. I was in New Orleans when Soldier Slim got killed. Where I'm from, every day somebody did.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Line. This is Damon Azali with Lisa Adler. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. Before we bring on our next guest, Evelyn Chen, I just wanted to let folks know who have been following the When the Levees Broke campaign. The Strategy Center sent five people to the Gulf Coast in New Orleans for a couple weeks around the anniversary of When the Levees Broke, and this coming Thursday, the 28th of September at 6:30, we're having a report back from New Orleans. And it's going to start at 6:30 at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard, the corner of Berendo. We have childcare, translation in Korean and Spanish, and it's going to be a good chance for folks to just see some pictures of what the Ninth Ward looks like, what New Orleans looks like after the levees broke. So we encourage everybody to join us. Please give us a call if you want more information at 213-387-2800. And here's Lisa with the next guest.
So we now want to welcome Evelyn Chen to the show. Evelyn is the Executive Director of Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice based in the Bay Area. Evelyn joins us to discuss the dangers posed by Proposition 85, a ballot initiative that, if passed, would require physicians to notify the parents or legal guardians of a minor seeking an abortion 48 hours before performing the operation. Welcome, Evelyn, to the show. We're pleased to have you on.
Thanks, Lisa and Damon. It's great to be here.
So, Evelyn, we're going to go into Proposition 85 in more detail later. For folks who remember, this is essentially the exact same proposition as Proposition 73 from last year, which voters defeated. But before we go into the specifics of 85, Evelyn, I wanted to ask you, what do you think the rights broader strategy is right now in terms of controlling a woman's right to choose? So what are they doing across the country to attempt to essentially overturn Roe v. Wade and control a woman's right to choose?
Well, I think right now what's happening on the right, which is, you know, basically been what they've been doing over the last decade or so, is kind of launching a front both on the state level and the national level. So what you see on the state level is that there are currently 34 states that now enforce parental consent or notification laws. And in Oregon this year, they're facing a ballot initiative on parental notification similar to Prop 85. And so if both Oregon and California pass, youth in both states are going to face real serious challenges to having accessible abortion care provided to them in terms of confidential and safe care. You know, by the way, this research shows that parental involvement laws, they've done research on kind of the laws in other states, and these laws do not reduce teen pregnancy or increase family communication. What they do is result in minors delaying counseling and medical care, which often can result in late-term abortions and carry high risk of complications. And some teens have even tried kind of self-aborting or seeking illegal, unsafe abortions to avoid parental involvement. And so, you know, research has shown that these laws are kind of having a very detrimental effect on the state level. Nationally, the threat is even bigger now than last year when Prop 73 was on the ballots, because of the potential for the Child Custody Protection Act, which was recently passed in the Senate in July. And basically, if it passes, it would make it a federal crime to transport a minor across state lines for the purposes of evading state abortion parental notification or consent laws. And this would mean grave consequences for our youth, because our teens would have no other choice but to turn to illegal and unsafe methods of terminating unwanted pregnancies. And then, you know, beyond kind of the parental involvement laws, we have kind of increasing state-level restrictions on a number of fronts, including laws that, you know, are requiring abstinence-only sex education and requiring parental notification for minors receiving contraception and treatment for sexually transmitted infections, and laws now that are coming up on the in states allowing pharmacists to refuse dispensing birth control and emergency contraception. So there's kind of a wide range of efforts that are being passed to really limit, restrict, and in South Dakota, as we could see, actually mm-hmm. ban abortion.
I mean, that's really, it seems like the reoccurring theme on this show is we're bringing you people who know about the next five or six laws that are going to be added to criminalize folks. So, I mean, also folks, we're going to have folks later in a couple of weeks on Proposition 83, which is actually trying to increase penalties for people who are convicted of sex offenses. But I think this whole thing right here, you limit a woman's right to choose and then you criminalize her for, basically trying to say, hey, this is my body, and I'm going to, do what I need to do to make sure that I'm healthy.
I think that those kind of, for those of us in the reproductive justice movement, we talk about kind of how communities are controlled by controlling, the bodies and sexuality and reproduction of women and girls, and that's actually kind of a strategic way that our communities are being regulated.
So in the light of that, let's just kind of talk broadly about Roe v. Wade, right? So, a lot of times there are laws that, protect certain rights or say they're giving you certain rights, but then actuality, when it comes down to it materially, that's not how it happens. So if we just take Roe v. Wade at this point, before the next version of the conservative Supreme Court takes over, does Roe v. Wade actually protect access for family planning services for abortion? And I say particularly with the shade of color, of class, and whatnot. Does that protect?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. There's been a lot of kind of publicity around kind of Roe v. Wade and when the court is going to overturn it. So
it's a when, it's not an if.
Well, I'm hoping that it won't be, but judging from kind of who's on the courts right now, there's a good chance that it, they're working to overturn it. But even as Roe, is on the books, low-income women, women of color, and young women have, the erosion, they have faced kind of, challenge upon challenge in terms of getting access to abortion. And so you see that with the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits anyone receiving Medicaid to be able to get abortion services. If you are a Native American and receiving health care from the Indian Health Services, they are prohibited, to provide abortion care services. And, of course, you have these parental consent laws, which are limiting and restricting minors' access to abortion. And so, and above and beyond that, there are, increasingly, we're finding that there's, maybe one abortion care provider in a county, for example. And so folks are, a lot of people, especially in rural areas, are having to find transportation and facing access issues in terms of just even receiving abortions that are, that is legal. And, in terms of the medical profession, we're seeing that it's being taught decreasing less and less doctors are receiving and students are receiving kind of training on how to do abortions. So, there's this multiple effect aside from the laws, but just kind of in the practice and in how things happen on the ground, that access to abortion is becoming increasingly limited.
Well, I think that's interesting. So you have this right, but there's no money to provide it. There's fewer numbers of providers who actually do it. People aren't educated to do it. You aren't educated around family planning. And so, therefore, the right is only in words and not in actuality.
That's right. That's right.
And I think the both, 73, and let's go into what actually the proposition does. I think both in 73 and now 85, one of the things that it does is puts more ability for parents who, quote unquote, weren't notified or whatnot to maybe come back and actually sue family care or abortion providers, and therefore, I would think would cause actually fewer and fewer numbers of of people want actually, the doctors actually wanting to do the procedures?
Yeah, there are a couple of things on that front. I mean, it is going to kind of create an increasingly hostile climate for doctors to provide abortions in a couple of ways. One, in terms of, you know, what you're saying is that the threat of a lawsuit by parents who weren't notified. But also, every doctor who provides an abortion would have to report that, and the state health department would then compile all of the, you know, data and specifics, including, you know, the doctor's name, and that report would become public, you know, would be available to the public. And so, which would increase kind of the public's scrutiny and anyone who wants to kind of target doctors who are providing abortions to be able to, you know, continue their attacks.
So Evelyn, so a lot of times I think, you know, the people in the pro-choice movement are pitted as, you know, wanting to use abortion as a birth control, you know, like as if abortion is this easy decision that women make and, you know, we have to stop making women, you know, using abortions like it's nothing. And we know that that's not true, right? Having an abortion is a very difficult decision that every young woman and woman in general has to make. And I think that many of us in the pro-choice movement also do wish to find ways to make abortion less necessary, right? To reduce the number of unintended or unwanted pregnancies. So, but of course, the right answer is abstinence only, right? And so I guess, you know, my question is how do you address the issue of making abortions less necessary, right? Of reducing the number of unintended pregnancies, but from a pro-woman's perspective, and from a right to choose perspective?
Well, I think, you know, to be clear that, again, if we're trying to, well, first of all, in California, teen pregnancy rates have dropped. Mm. And so, and they continue to drop. And so, and that's without kind of any parental notification or consent law on the books. And so I think that, you know, in terms of if the goal is to reduce unwanted pregnancies, these kinds of laws, again, like I said, research has shown, they don't address and they don't result in that intended effect. And if, you know, the goal is for us to perfect the health and safety of our young women, what we want is to provide more clinics and services and less barriers to kind of to having our daughters be able to access safe and confidential health services. And I think that it's interesting because I think, you know, within the pro-choice movement, there is this kind of sense of like, you know, maybe we want to decrease the level of unwanted pregnancies and abortions. And I think that that goes down kind of a slippery slope of, you know, thinking about abortion as something that, I mean, abortion is a medical procedure, mm-hmm. and it's something that should be treated as such, in my opinion, and that, you know, just like you said, Lisa, research has shown that women and girls do not use abortion as birth control, and that's definitely a argument that the right uses to kind of rile people up, mm-hmm. and it's a myth.
Mm-hmm.
So in answering your question, so for ACRJ, we're looking at kind of how do we think about keeping our young women healthy and safe and be able to thrive is to provide, and again, we really look at this issue within the context of their lives. And so we want to, you know, address and organize to address issues around safety and poverty and, you know, better schools and more options for these young women so that they, you know, not only can survive kind of the challenges that they face, but also that they're able to contribute to their communities and also, you know, have hope that they can grow and develop and have families if they want and live really lives that they can contribute and thrive in.
Mm-hmm. So now that we've done, you know, somewhat of the broader picture, Evelyn, let's go back and look a little bit more specifically at, you know, Prop 85 and, you know, one sort of are there any differences between Prop 85 and Prop 73? How did they manage to get virtually the exact same initiative on the ballot? And then just what specifically would it do once, you know, if it passed and once it took effect?
Okay. So, yeah, it's the same group of people who put Prop 73 on the ballot last year. And it's basically, The biggest financial supporter is James Holman, a millionaire from San Diego who owns several conservative newspapers and who opposes the use of all forms of birth control. Mm. And so basically they, you know, he and this cohort, they were able to put this back on the ballot, and it's virtually identical to Prop 73. They did take out the language that would amend the Constitution to define life at conception. So that's one of the main kind of differences. But, you know, like Prop 73, Prop 85 still endangers the health and safety of young girls and women in our communities. It still creates a hostile climate for doctors who want to provide abortion services. And it's still part of the erosion, as we talked about earlier, of safe and confidential abortion services for young women and girls. And so if it passes, what's going to happen is that, as you mentioned at the beginning, that young women under the age of 18 seeking abortion care services, this proposition would require doctors to notify their parents at least 48 hours before performing an abortion. If she decides that she doesn't want her parents notified, she does have the option of going in front of a judge and presenting her case and, you know, and basically ask for a waiver. You know,
who's going to want to do that?
Right, exactly. And especially for immigrants and communities of color and low-income communities, the court system is not the most welcoming for youth in our communities, and it's not the most accessible, and that's just not a viable option for youth who want to receive confidential services.
I mean, I think that's the... That's the key to this whole piece, is that all these laws basically limit access for working class, poor people of color. Because in terms of, you know, other folks, they'll have the money to figure out what doctors that they can still use. They can go across state lines, et cetera, et cetera. But really, it's pretty crazy to me in terms of the kind of inundation of police in our communities for a young woman of color to say, oh, I'm going to go into the court, you know, that probably has, you know, done stuff in terms of attacking my family, putting them in prison, et cetera, to say, okay, I'm going to go and try to get a waiver out of this kind of thing. So I just think that just should be really clear to a lot of the folks who are pro-choice but don't necessarily see the kind of the color lens that is really important to see on it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that low-income communities and communities of color are going to face a lot of barriers if this is passed. And, you know, currently without parental notification laws, youth from our communities are, you know, already face numerous barriers to receiving timely and safe reproductive health care due to race and class issues. And, you know, for low-income youth who don't have health insurance, and free and confidential clinics are often the only source of health care where they can receive information and services for all other health issues. And so if these teens stop going to those clinics because they think their parents will find out, it means that they won't receive any health care at all, and could, you know, potentially mean that they take matters in their own hands, which could result in really bad consequences. And then parents from immigrant communities, you know, what we're finding is that oftentimes want the school system, want the healthcare system to provide accurate, safe, and timely information and healthcare to their daughters. And once, you know, immigrant families understand the implications of parental notification initiatives, they often vote against them. And, you know, just today, La Opinion issued a very strong No on 85 editorial, which is just great in terms of kind of making sure that, you know, Latino communities understand kind of what's happening around this initiative.
That's great. So, Evelyn, we have only a few more minutes remaining, but talk to us a little bit about where the Democrats are in this discussion. I know last year was 73. It felt like most of the efforts of the Democrats were focused on defeating Schwarzenegger's slate of propositions, but that 73 got sort of swept up in that, you know, no on everything. You know, are people really speaking out more on 85 this time around, and what are the efforts that are going on to defeat 85?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, labor has come on to, last year they did not support it, and last year they did not take a position on it, and this year they are came out against it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, pro-choice Democrats definitely are coming out, you know, against it. I think in terms of progressive communities, we're seeing, because of the foundation that was built last year around kind of getting communities of color through the work that ACRJ did, as well as California Latinas for Reproductive Justice and other progressive kind of reproductive justice groups that brought in social justice groups into this, working on this in terms of their GOTV work with their members. We're finding that a lot of that foundation was built from last year, and now organizations are coming on board much quicker. They have a better understanding of how Prop 85 is related to and is inherently connected to the social justice issues that they're working on, mm-hmm. and are working to sign on and mobilize their constituencies to vote against it.
Great. And I know that the Bus Riders Union also has taken a stance against 85. We'll be doing our own voter education outreach in addition to Proposition 1B that we were talking about earlier. So if people want to learn more about your organization, Evelyn, how can they do that?
We are on the web at www.reproductivejustice.org, and there you can download our toolkit that we're just putting out in terms of how to talk to your communities and your families about Prop 85, and we also will have a calendar of events. And I also just want to say that California Latinas for Reproductive Justice is hosting a Women of Color Community Forum Thursday, October 12th in L.A. at the Emanuel Presbyterian Church, looking at Prop 85 and how it's a reproductive justice issue and how it will impact communities of color.
And do you have a contact phone number for them?
Yes, they are at 213-270-5258.
Great. Thank you, Evelyn. It was really good to have you on again. Hopefully we'll have to talk to you around propositions coming up on the ballot for more about your work next time.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you, Evelyn. So that's going to be it for this this issue of Voices from the Front Lines. This is Damon Azali with Lisa Adler. Thanks for joining us. We'd like to thank Penny Newman and Evelyn Shin. Today we heard music from Damian Marley, Ice Life, and Kekele is going to be coming on pretty soon. There it is. You can listen to previous shows of Voices at www.thestrategycenter.org, and you can send comments to voices@thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, our engineer, Maggie LaPique, and we'll see you next week from Voices from the Front Lines. Please also remember, Thursday the 28th, 6:30 at Emanuel Presbyterian Church, report back with from the Labor Community Strategy Center from their delegation visit to New Orleans, 213-387-2800 for more information. And please stay tuned for Susie Weissman on Beneath the Surface. We'll see you next week.